Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next interview was an absolute delight. We had a wonderful time. Marina Cordoni and Gail Harvey and I chatting about their new film, Never Saw It Coming. One of the things right out of the gate that we found out really quickly is that apparently intelligent people do swear. So you're going to want to stay tuned and find out why that's the case. We talked about activism and equality for women, and we talk about why this is a feminist drama and why it's not a traditional mystery. This is a Linwood Barclay novel that's been turned into a film. He wrote the screenplay for it, and Gail directs and Marina produces. And we talked about pushing boundaries. Why life isn't tidy, and this sense of sort of almost quiet desperation that so many of us live with. We talk about hard work and planning, and why it's all about communication. And one of the things that I really enjoyed sort of teasing out a little bit with Marina and Gail was this idea of how collaborative the process is, how collaborative it is to make a film, to make a piece of art. We talk about commitment to women and justice and equality and how the Toronto International Film Festival is doing that in a very unique way this year. And also something called the cement ceiling. How interesting is that? So you're going to want to stay tuned. Coming right up, Never Saw It Coming with Marina Cordoni and Gail Harvey. And don't forget davidpecklive.com for more information about my writing and my speaking, and also face-to-face-live.ca for many other interviews about a whole host of really interesting things with a whole lot of engaging people. And two of those are coming right again right now. Marina Cordoni and Gail Harvey talking about their new film, Never Saw It Coming.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by two very special guests today. We have two filmmakers, producers, directors, writers, Canadian women here with us today to talk about their new film, Never Saw It Coming. Marina Cordoni and Gail Harvey are here with us to talk about the film and the industry and probably about the story, too. Thanks, Marina, Gail, for joining me today. Really appreciate it.
Thrilled to be. Such a pleasure, David. Thank you.
So let's just dive right in. I love the title, and I know it's based on a mystery novel by a pretty recognized Canadian author, and I'm sure you guys are going to talk a little bit about that. But I'm going to dive right in.
Linwood Barclay. That's it.
Linwood Barclay. Thank you. Didn't either of you see coming during the production of this film?
I want to cast Eric Roberts in the film, and he was in Qatar doing a TV series. So he originally read the script, said he wanted to do the movie, and then it was very difficult to get him to come, but he finally came. He had 4 days off, so he flew from Qatar, shot the movie for 2 days in Sudbury, and flew back.
So flew from Qatar to Sudbury and back to Qatar.
That's right.
Wow.
And he had to work a day in Qatar, and he did it because he loved the script, and also he and I are friends, so he wanted to to be a good friend, I think. And he's such an incredible actor. So Marina and I were up many times in the middle of the night calling producers in Qatar and, oh, my God, he's not going to come. They can't do it. And finally, it all worked out.
Yeah,
the wonderful logistics of filmmaking, right?
Well, yeah, and you guys chose so you didn't go local. You weren't working in the GTA. You were mostly shot in Sudbury. Is that right?
Yes, we did. We shot up north. We, I think we're privileged in Ontario to have a lot of government support surrounding film and television, and the Northern Ontario Heritage Fund offers an opportunity to go up and help their economics in their part of the province. So they provide us with some financing around the film, and we go up there and we use their facilities and hire their crew and shoot films.
So it's clearly a mystery. It's a thriller. I mean, I certainly elements of Hitchcock. You really don't know what's coming in the story, you know, just on the surface. But what about underneath that, you know, the opening? And I so love the establishing shot in the film with the car in the ice, and just that whole, just life is tenuous, right? I mean, it's, you know, I know you start with a sort of those, I guess they're beautiful drone shots, I think, but
yeah.
The car on the ice is just such a wonderful way to begin any kind of film, it seems to me. But could you guys talk about what's sort of below the surface here? I mean, we've got this psychic. Can we talk about the story? Are we going to spoil it for people?
There are a lot of spoilers, so I don't know how far we can go. We don't want to give it away.
We definitely don't want to give it away.
Linwood has a lot of fans, so several people have read the book, but I think it's one of his lesser known books.
Oh, okay.
There's so many twists and turns, and that's why the title is so appropriate for the movie. Underneath the film, underneath the surface of the ice, I guess, like I've often said, to me, this is like a feminist drama. Because you know, with Emily Hampshire's character, Keisha, like it's incredible how it turns around and what happens in the story. And I think there's a place that I can't talk about specifics, but I'm hoping women will stand up in the audience and applaud.
So is it about, for me at the end, you're kind of left with a lot of questions. That's for sure. Not only from a narrative perspective and where things are going to go, it's clearly there's a potential for I guess a part two, I suppose.
Part two.
We did see it coming.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, isn't that kind of the way it is? I mean, this is for me, you know that metaphor, and it's kind of overused, but the whole iceberg, right? You got a little bit above the water and what's really going on, what's really happening, where life is really, where the rubber's meeting the road, it's all below the ice, right? And so it's the implications of it all. And there's just one surprise after another, it seems, in this film. And for me, that's, you know, my background is academically is in philosophy. So I love choice. I love this idea of, becoming who we are by the decisions we make in the heat of the moment. And this is definitely one of the, for me anyway, one of the subtexts of Never Saw It Coming, for sure.
I think that's what the audience is going to get out of it, David, in that this isn't your usual fare. It's not your traditional mystery. It's a very artistic whodunit in a sense, but not that sort of tell your audience what they're about to see. And, you know, both with Linwood's writing and with Gail's visionary directing, it's really been brought to life in this film. And I do think the audience will get something out of that. And I love the idea that they might walk away with questions.
Well, it's so interesting. There's so many one-liners too that really stood out for me, and I love that. And there, I think it's Kirk's character who's clearly wrapped up in a whole lot of things in a whole lot of different ways. Talk about subtext and different narratives. But there's a scene, I think, where he's talking to the police officer, and he's like the garbage bag, and he says it's just garbage. And I just kind of laughed out loud, and I went, you know what? It's never really just garbage.
Kirk has the best lines in this film, and what a great supporting actor Sean Benson is in this film. And I'm this isn't a spoiler because I want the audience to look out for it when he says, "You owe me $5."
Oh, same.
Yeah, that's literally my favorite line in the film.
Yeah,
every time I heard it, I don't know how many times I've seen this film with the editing and this. Every time I hear that line, I laugh. And the thing I think that's also, I was hoping that it would be like this, but it's so funny, you know. Even though like mm-hmm. with so many things, it's like a black comedy, and I'm going maybe it's a really sick sense of humor. I don't know. But, like, there are things in that movie that every time I see them, I laugh. And probably shouldn't be laughing.
Right.
But we screened it in Whistler. Remember, Marina? And, like, at first the audience was like, are we supposed to laugh? And then as it went on, people were laughing uproariously at things. You know, when it was almost like if you have permission to laugh in this film.
I think it's that discomfort. Yeah. You know, like the feeling of this is so not right, that it's maybe right. I don't know. And so there's a level of discomfort. It's almost when people, you know, tend to laugh at funerals because they're feeling emotionally well. And that's the case in this movie. There are scenes where you're just like, this is so outrageous. I need to laugh at it. And that's again, a process that I think is enjoyable.
And I wonder too if some of the appeal of this kind of a film, this kind of a story, is how I hope it is anyway. Because I mean, isn't this what we really want to do? I think anyone who's, I don't know, telling story or making film or writing poetry. I mean, don't you want people to stand back and see, you know, light? What does Diane Ackerman says? Light shining in the darkness. You know. Anyway, don't we put ourselves kind of into those positions and say, wow, would I have done that? So you've got this mystery, you've got this whodunit, but aren't we also at the same time going, I don't think I would have made that choice, or maybe I would have, you know, when
yeah,
when
it's like, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, go.
Sure, it's like if someone's children are hungry, are they wrong to have stolen the loaf of bread? You know,
right.
That's the simplest way to state that, and I think I put that in one of my director's vision or one of the notes I had to write. You know, so it's interesting that the Keisha character is very, I think the audience will really be rooting for her.
Right.
Even though she's not making all the right choices necessarily. But, she comes across as strong and smart and, you know, and she handles stuff. And I think that she's really sympathetic. And that was, at the beginning, one of my worries that we cast Emily because she's such an incredible actor. And for what she brings to the role. And also, she's got the right amount of, you know, quirkiness that you could believe that this could be her life. Yet she's, like, incredibly intelligent actor and just kind of the way she handled the whole part because it's very complex. Many of these parts are extremely complex because there are so many twists and turns and decisions that are made and... you know, where are we going to go now kind of situations. Those parts aren't easy. So, we were fortunate enough to get an amazing cast. I think everybody nailed it. I really do.
Did you guys have anybody else in mind, and I don't mean from a casting perspective, but from a storytelling perspective, in the back of your mind, from a mystery sort of thriller, you know, noir crime thriller approach, were there directors or writers that you were thinking of along the way?
Well, I always kind of thought it was an interesting combo of like a Hitchcockian kind of film with elements of Tarantino.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, right? I definitely went to Cronenberg with the knitting needle scene, that's for sure.
Yeah, Cronenberg. I was just going to say, and David Cronenberg, any films that are like that, that push the boundaries in some ways, yet remain grounded in reality.
Right.
You know, which I believe this film does. I mean, it's like we go, what the heck? But you know, it's the performances are all real, and I believe they're all very powerful because everybody just got it, you know. And so sometimes you go, well, will everybody get it? I don't know, but they all got it, you know. Nick Sereno was amazing, and Katie Boland, who's my daughter, I think she does an incredible part as Eric Roberts' daughter. And and even Diane Dacula, who's in the opening scene going through the ice. I mean, she came up for one day, and that's such a chilling scene.
It really is.
Yeah, it's chilling. And it's like, holy cow, what a way to start a movie. I mean, that's what I thought.
And what a day of shooting. It was, I would say, David, probably for me, I can't speak for Gail, but probably one of the most important days of my life.
Hmm.
Like, not just my working life, but there were so many situations that we had to look at because we actually put a car through the ice. This was not CGI'd. I mean, there were special effects that came in afterwards, but we had an 80-foot crane.
Wow, okay.
Basically what looked like a pond in northern Ontario, and we did an overnight shoot, and it was freezing.
Oh,
like, it was minus 28, Gail? I can't remember exactly, but
I remember it
was
wasn't
so cold.
I thought it was going to be, though. I mean, I didn't feel as cold as I thought I was going to feel, so that was good. But, you know, we had to measure the ice, and, you know, all through the time, and we shot that first because we didn't want the ice to melt at all, and had to install it enough for people to work on it, but thin enough so they could cut the hole in it, so we shot on two sections of the ice, one where the car was on top of the ice. We did that part, and then we had a part of the ice where they cut a big hole in, and then, you know, they had a big what would you call that, like a thing that came down like a boom boom boom, one of those things on a
the construction
the
ball
the ice.
Oh, like a wrecking ball.
Ball. Yeah, the wrecking ball. That's it.
The wrecking ball. That's the title of
the wrecking ball.
That's the title of somebody's autobiography. I'm not sure who it's going to be.
And also, it's a very strong image, right? Like, what I'd love to add to this is, you know, thinking about that kind of what I would describe an action scene.
Mm.
This is not a typical Canadian film, you know, style of production. I don't know many films that have taken that kind of filmmaking, you know, to that extent. And, you know, it was literally a 24-hour job that we were doing out there. And, you know, and Gail's perspective and vision of, you know, getting the drone shots to bring us into an artistic feeling and a sense of comfort
right.
and ease. And you're sitting back in your chair and then suddenly, there we go.
Right.
And so to me, what I really loved, and that's what, you know, with a director like Gail, you know, that vision, immediately when you're talking to a director and that vision is coming off the page, it's, you know, I could already see it, and it was extraordinary. Just extraordinary.
I love what you said about one of the most important days of my life. And Gail, I think you said, you talked about, and I forget who it was, one of the actors who, you know, just, this is about real life. And I think just to try to sort of bring this full circle and bear with me here, but I think one of the last lines in the film, I think is Keisha's character. She says to her son on, you know, play me something real.
Right.
On the piano. And for me, this is a film, this is a deeply existential film. This is about, you know, for me, it's all about choice. It's about responsibility. It's about stepping into it. I mean, talk about being, you know, de Beauvoir talks about being thrown into the world, not of our own making, and not knowing what to do with that, right? Not knowing what to do with that freedom. And here we are in the middle of this big mess, and yet it's very real. And how do we react in these situations? That's what I mean, obviously, there's a whole lot of other things we could be talking about. But I think, you know, keeping it real, most important day of my life, you know, play me something real. It's just an interesting kind of a thought.
Well, I think everybody's life has elements of that in it. And I mean, you just look at the world now with what's going on. And I mean, you could almost look at our film as a metaphor for what's going on in the world now in a weird way, you know, and choices and how do you pull yourself up out of it and what do you do? And, you know, yeah, that maybe there is room for movie two, a sequel.
Oh, well,
it is like watching that life go on and what happens and then bang, you know, the ending, off she goes. I think that the audience is going to draw their own conclusions about what will happen to her.
Of course, of course.
And I wanted it to be that way. You know, that scene was something that I asked to be added when we were shooting. You know, I went through the ending and I talked to Linwood, and he sent me a couple of themes. Because I kind of wanted it to be open-ended, including that scene in the cop shop of Tamara Pendence when she's looking at the things in the plastic bag. What is it? What is it? She calls. Interesting. And then she goes. See, you know, I think life is never, like, final. I think
right.
It does always continue. And so I think that definitely ties in with your existential analysis.
Well, very, right? Very.
I agree with you.
And very open-ended, right? And one of the thoughts, yeah. I thought a little bit of I don't know if you guys remember the Sam Raimi film, A Simple Plan, back in the late 90s, but just how that spiral downwards can come so quickly, how things can kind of get out of control in a matter of seconds, right? And sometimes we are the people who we are when we know, when we think about those decisions that we might make in situations that we may not even cross one day in our lives. I mean, that's what's so fascinating to me about these kinds of stories, these kinds of parables, really.
And it goes to what Gail was saying about, you know, life is not tidy.
Yeah, exactly.
When we make films that are that tidy, we're creating an obsession about, you know, our own lives not being correct. And when I watch a film like Never Saw It Coming, in fact, take it a step back when I read the book and then the screenplay and then, you know, working on the film, it's that sense of desperation that everyone has, regardless of their, you know, their position in life. It's like, well, what if there isn't enough money? What if we're in a small town? What if my boyfriend isn't the nicest guy? What if, you know, where are we going with this and what happens? Well, in life, it's very complicated. So I think, you know, if we keep true to form and we look at film like the art that meets the commercial world, then this is surely a winner. And I've been, you know, sort of thinking in this conversation, I think we should make a trilogy, you know, Never saw it coming. You didn't see it coming.
Now we see it coming. Yeah.
Yes.
I don't know. Do we have the energy? We need a little.
So I'm going to put. Can I just put a title out there? What else I didn't see coming? Could that be part two?
How many things can I not see coming?
That's right.
You know? This is life.
When everything builds up, yes, it's like life. Like, you know, I mean, how many times have you been in your life going, oh, no, not this too. Like, how could this happen too, you know? And so I don't want to give away the story, but I think, you know, you've seen it, so you know what I'm talking about. So, you know, when she's faced with the situation, what do I do now? And Emily said to me, and she just nailed the scene, and she said, I don't know how to play this. What would I do? And I said to her, just roll up your sleeves. Just roll up your sleeves and you get to work. And she said that direction saved me. It's amazing. And she just, you know, just did a great job. And
it's so great. I love the metaphor of that as well. By the way, the opening scenes or the establishing shots with the light snow. I mean, it's just absolutely gorgeous. And talk about, you know, just being almost a shock of recognition from, like you said, I think Marina, but these beautiful slow mo shots. You know, this artistic piece that's drawing us in, and then we're just, yeah. The ice is going to break.
The first clue, that was all very planned. I kind of layered the first clue that this is not what you think is when they're running into the, you know, when the parents go in with Keisha and they're going in, and there's a sideways shot as they're running down the hall.
Right, yes.
That's the first clue to the audience that this movie's not what you think it's going to be. So, you know, I don't know if it worked or not, but that was in my mind anyway.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And we're back to the real life discussion, right? How it seems to me anyway. A question I've thought of in the last couple of days is how I'm always fascinated, especially when it's a film that's adapted from a book. How much of the author, how much of the director, how much of the screenwriter was the author, but I mean, such a collaborative process, and I think it's one of the reasons why I love films so much. There's so many.
Yeah, well, that's why I stopped being a photographer when I started making films. I thought, wow, this is like everything. It's every art form, music, visual. I mean, I was always strong with camera, degree in psychology. I love people. I love actors. I love And this just brings it all together. And Linwood and I are very old friends. We were journalists together, actually, at the Toronto Star. And then we reconnected because we both have places in Prince Edward County.
Okay.
And we were at dinner one night, and he said to me, how do you get a movie made? Like, many of my books have been, like, bidding wars for big Hollywood studios, but nothing had ever been made.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah. I said, do you have a little book? Like, some little book that maybe I could do up here. So he sent me Never Say, he said, I do, actually. And he sent me Never Saw It Coming. So I read it and liked it, and then Marina and I have been trying to work together for ages. We have known each other also for a very long time and worked together, but Marina was the most amazing person for years in distribution and helping and being a filmmaker's champion and everything. So, you know, this is the first thing that we've done together with Marina producing with me. So it was great. So I sent her the book, and then we talked about it, and then... Linwood is a genius writer and a wonderful person, and I said, do you want to write the screenplay? So he did, and so, you know, went back and forth. I read what he did, and he literally wrote the screenplay in 10 days.
Wow.
Because for a book, he knew the story so well. I know structure and, you know, filmmaking so well that, you know, it was about what do you take away more than anything else and making sure it was all balanced. And I had a couple of ideas for it, and he said, you know, what he said to me after, it made me feel really good. He said, I wish those ideas were in the book.
Nice.
That was nice. So it was truly a very collaborative situation.
How many of those decisions on set, when you've got 24 hours and a wrecking ball overhead and it's really cold out, where you just go, you know what, just roll up your sleeves? To either of you, really, in truth. I mean,
yeah,
I think that's
well,
just,
yeah.
we're talking about the craft now, right? We're talking about your experience and the knowledge you bring to bear and what's on the page and what's in the moment.
Yeah,
that's go ahead, Gail.
I was going to say, you know, I feel very confident when I'm on set. I've been on set for years and years and years. I watched amazing directors work. I had amazing directors as mentors, Arthur Penn, Wim Wenders, Dan Petrie, Philip Borsos. You know, people were very kind to me, and I learned a lot. I try to give that back now in our community. But you just have to be – I just feel like I always roll up my sleeves, you know. Like,
right.
I read the story. I know the story inside out emotionally, artistically, how I want to shoot it. A lot of planning is done. And then, you know, when you're on set, it's exciting, but it's like put one foot in front of the other.
Right,
kind of what it always is like, you know?
Yeah, and I would add to that exactly, you know, what you said, Gail, about the planning on the production side. It can be deeply challenging because you need to meet art and commerce, we're not Hollywood in Toronto in the sense that we don't operate on a privatized economic system. We are government funded, and we have distribution advances. So there is a bit of private equity, but it's business to business,
right?
Mostly, and so we don't have as much as we would always want.
Right.
So we have to almost work a little bit harder and plan more. And Gail's incredibly talented at planning and very experienced. I, you know, as her producing partner, did not have any qualms or any fears about that day because we had planned it.
Right.
And we had done it according to, you know, the vision. We didn't have to take anything out. And that's the thing about an experienced director is also a grown-up, you know, not kicking around on set going, but I want this. I want it this way. And,
but I'm also, that's the wank. I'm very responsible. I mean, you have to be when you work in Canada. I mean, our budgets are I don't know what this would have been in the States.
Low.
We probably had one-tenth of the money that would be a low-budget film in the States here. So, you know, we shot it in very quickly. You know, it just went very well. And you just really have to have everything written down. I was so planned that I actually went to all the locations with the DP locations guy and first AD and actually shot many of the scenes on my iPhone.
Oh, is that right? Hey, wow.
Yeah, just so that I mean, iPhone is irreplaceable now. So I did that just so that on the day you could, you know, it's all about communication. So, okay, this is what we're shooting. Yeah, and it was actually quite funny. because we had our locations manager was playing Eric McCormick's part. And, you know, or sometimes he was Emily Hampshire or something. Just to figure out where everybody was going to stand. That way the DP knows what the lighting's got to be. And, again, in a collaborative way, you know, I always work in a collaborative way. So we know we have a certain amount of time. I timeline everything. So timelined everything with the first AD. So I always know in my mind how much time I have for each scene. You know, and there's no, you can't, you just don't do, I never
it's,
do overtime.
It's so interesting
especially
to hear you.
On the television.
It's almost like you're talking like a project manager, right? It's like you've got a Gantt chart. Like you're so organized about the shooting and how the like you said, Marina, the commerce versus the art, you know, and where do the two meet?
Mm. Now that is, you know, I shot list everything and I rarely take it out of my pocket. You have to, directing is an interesting combo of being very organized but thinking on your feet and just looking at the situation and reading the room and figuring out, you know, the best way in that moment. And I often say directing, like sculpting emotion, you know, that's kind of what it is. You know, you just kind of, you know, it's a people skill job.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, for sure. You're a relationship manager behind the camera, right?
Yeah.
So I want to sort of focus. Whoa! Did you guys hear that? I'm in the middle of a thunderstorm here, where I'm sitting in my
office
today.
I didn't
hear it at all.
Oh, good. Well, if we lose power, we'll get you back live, and hopefully a matter of minutes. But I just wanted to give you that heads up.
And it's terribly exciting, though. Like we didn't see that coming.
There we go. We got to get at least one more reference like that in before the interview ends.
What is that, you know, the horrible marketing world where it's like you got to repeat the brand name at 65 times in 2 minutes?
That's right. You know,
that kind of thing. I'm joking, of course.
Yes, no, totally. Yeah. So I think it was, Gail, I think you had mentioned about a scene, one particular scene, but I think it's a theme throughout the film for sure, but a particular scene where Keisha's character does something and the audience, you're hoping that the audience and maybe particularly the women in the audience are going to, you know, stand up and cheer or applaud or...
Yay, thank God.
Yeah. Right. So can you talk a little bit about that and just in the and I hope you don't mind, but going, you know, the Me Too movement, we're in the middle of it. This is a story about gender disparity, it seems to me as well. And I mean, could you talk a little bit about that in relation to, I don't know, maybe the Canadian filmmaking business, what it's been like, you know.
I can speak from my experience. I think, you know, I've been very fortunate because I look back and I really don't know how I got my first jobs because there were no women really getting hired on TV shows. It was rare. And even to this day, you know, because when you work in Canada, you make your money doing TV and then you do your movies, you know.
Right.
So it's similar now. Sometimes I'm still the only woman. Now, the networks are getting behind us, which has been fantastic. That's been a change over the last 4 or 5 years where CBC said that they have to hire 50% women. And what I always say is if they hired 100% women for the next 100 years, it might be even.
You know? Have you done the calculation on that?
No, but for sure. I mean, it's true. Like,
yeah.
It wasn't even talked about, you know?
Right.
But I have to say I've been very fortunate. I have a wonderful life and I have the opportunity to work with amazing people. And you know, people like Marina, who's like, I would say you're probably, you're more vocal than I am in the Me Too movement.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's not that it's gone, you know, still the same kind of bullshit happens, but this movie, I think it's like right in your face, like with her relationship. And I, you know, a lot of people have been in relationships like that. I mean, that's extreme, obviously. That's extreme. But I mean, I think there's a scene in the hallway where she says, "You're the man," where I felt as soon as she did that scene, I thought, okay, that justifies what's coming up.
The follow-up line is, "I couldn't manage without you," I think.
Yeah. So that kind of, degradation, I think is, you know, what happened in that relationship. And how smug he is, kind of after she says it, I felt that was representative of, you know, probably st- stuff that we've all dealt with in various ways, you know? Now that is, I'll say it again, that is very extreme, but...
Well, and I love.
I thought it was important, you know, and she's a strong character. I love that,
right.
You know, she's a strong female character, incredibly strong, and Emily nailed it, so... You know,
well, her line was so telling too. I think it was a little later on. It might even have been the same scene. Maybe it was a little later on in the film near the end. But the whole this where she says, "I don't know how I ever let you into my life. You're the one who conned me," and I thought that was really telling for so many different reasons. You know, and how many of us have kind of been in a situation like that. And again, you know, you talked about Gail about just, you know, stepping into it and stepping forward. We don't really have a sense for the decisions and choices we've made until we look back, and then it starts to hopefully make some sense, right?
And they're usually your subconscious
reasons
people pick things, right, that you need to become more aware of, and maybe as you get older you can try and figure all that out. Not easy.
Really
isn't easy.
Not at all. Well, I think we choose, you know, what we want at the time, and then we discover it's not what we want, or there's challenges, and how are we going to get out now? So there's this feeling, and I think this goes across the board, relationships, jobs, friendships, you know, where there's a sense of feeling trapped and helpless and hopeless. And, you know, that character speaks to that as well.
Well, it, you know, doesn't Keisha at one point, when they're in the middle of, I think it's her and Kirk, and she says, I give people hope. And I think that's what great thing about filmmaking and storytelling and again just about creating art. I mean, isn't that what great relationships are about? You know, this idea of hope. You know, the what is next, and we don't really see what's coming, right? But we gotta have hope.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Like, you never know. You're right. Existential questions of life, like, you know, it's all those big questions. What is death? Why are we here? Where do we come from? I'm not comparing our film to that. But, I mean, you really don't know, and you really don't know anything. And life turns on a dime, and the only constant in life is change.
Right.
So I always told my children that. You know?
So cliche. So cliche on a certain level, and yet so true and so important to realize every day. How do you guys feel about TIFF and where they're heading with Share Her Journey and this 5-year commitment to you know, fighting for gender equity and I think they're even saying justice for women. It's sort of along the same lines of your 100% women for 100 years. Things might be even.
Well, my daughter did a film, and she was involved in the first one last year, her short film called Lolita, Katie Poland, who's also an actor. She directed, wrote, and starred in that film, and that was part of that Share the Journey. So I'm really thrilled that happened and that's happening. Marina, what do you think?
Well, I fully support any organization that steps out of this darkness that we have been going through right now, you know, since the Me Too movement, in that, you know, I feel that it's been a lot of a denial. Because this has existed forever in a day, but there's been a trigger, as we know, with the Me Too movement. And, you know, for TIFF, what I love about TIFF this year in particular is their commitment to female directors, their commitment to equality and to justice. Mm-hmm. Her journey is an amazing, you know, opportunity to bring newer female directors into the light. But what I love the most is that in comparison to the Venice Film Festival this year, who has come out publicly and said it is not their responsibility with respect to quality, and that is their reason behind not, you know, bringing in female directors, which in a way is saying, the producing side of it, or the vision of the director, is not strong as the male submissions that they've gotten.
Saying you suck, really.
What I'm seeing, though, is that I said in my social media, I basically said, hang on a minute. But Venice and TIFF are at the same time.
Right.
So therefore, it's the same projects being submitted. And TIFF has way more female-directed films in this year's festival, and Venice is saying there weren't enough of quality. So I just look at that and I applaud TIFF. I think there's a long way to go with all of it. And I feel very lucky to be in Canada right now where our federal and provincial funding makes it law. You know, there has to be gender parity. And that is the only way we can get out of the injustice and the backlash.
And do you think, and, you know, sadly, we're going to have to wrap up the conversation in a couple of minutes here, but do you, I mean, clearly, you know, it sounds like things are changing. It sounds, of course, sounds like things are getting better. And, you know, are you guys giving people hope when you're thinking about these things and having these conversations? Is there reason to think that we're getting to that place 100 years from now, Gail?
Well, you know, I can only hope, but I will also say that I can't really fund a large budget movie with my career, even though I've been working for so long. And I would say that, you know, most of my films have been successful. I'm an extremely successful television director, but, you know, I can only go to a certain height.
Right.
Marina,
that brings
it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, no, I think you're absolutely right, Gail. And I think that that's a really important issue. And one that I look at on a day-to-day basis as a producer, as a woman in the film industry with credentials, with success, with accomplishments, I call it the cement ceiling.
This isn't
a glass ceiling, it's cement.
Hmm.
So a director like Gail, what we're hearing is, okay, well, you know, we'll fund at the lower budget, but
right.
what about the $10 and $20 million film budget level? You know, so I think it's, for me, it's beyond, the Me Too movement has taken my personal feeling beyond just the sexual harassment, which is huge in itself. But now it's about economics too. I'm starting to see, hang on a minute, I don't have as many resources. I'm working. So is it smoke and mirrors, right? Are you trying to say to me, oh, but you're working, but I don't have enough? And that's where it's at, for me at least, in terms of looking at the next level. And to answer your question, David, about providing hope, I sure hope so. I talk to a lot of women who are emerging producers, emerging directors, emerging writers, and I talk very positively to them about what this industry is about. And that's all we can do. And we keep putting one foot in front of the other.
One last question.
You gotta
love a film that uses a rough trade in the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
All touch, no contact. I couldn't believe it. And it was like this blast from the past. It was just, and it was just such a, I don't know, iconic kind of moment for me as soon as I heard her voice.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, well, I love Carol. And I love Mary Margaret O'Hara. My Body's in Trouble is one of my favorite songs. And the other song is by my son, Michael Boland, who's heading huge strides, up and coming hip hop artist. So I thought it was an interesting combo of
nice.
Kind of a bit of a throwback, but also modern.
Right.
I have a modern feel of the film, and I think that those songs do have a modern feel, even though they are throwbacks. That's a different recording that Carol did on her own. It's not not the Rough Trade one.
Right.
And you know, I just thought that it was perfect for the film. I thought it was perfect, and I think you know. I hope that, you know, many young people will get to see who those women are, because they were iconic for me, both of them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. No, I love what you said. I mean, it isn't a prophetic artistic voice. I mean, a voice kind of ahead of their time, right? So relevant still today, right?
I think so. Yeah. I really
and just so cool. Right?
That's right.
They're just so cool.
Yes. I remember a lot of leather for Carol Pope.
Yeah, she's still wearing leather. I just saw her perform. She performed at the Duke, actually, a few months ago.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah,
what
great.
What a blast I've had chatting with you guys today. I so appreciate your time. If you don't do a part two to Never Saw It Coming, maybe we can do a part two to the interview down the road.
Oh, that'll be great. David, it's been truly a pleasure. What great questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We've been talking.
So much fun, David.
Yeah, thanks to you both. We've been talking to Marina Cordoni and Gail Harvey today about their new film, Never Saw It Coming. Can you tell us, we're going to be publishing this soon. When is it playing? In the near future?
So it opens in Toronto at Cineplex Yonge and Dundas Square, August 17th. Check your listings, and then we'll move it on from there. It'll be a bit of a theatrical tour.
Fantastic. Well, listen, congratulations again on the film, and thank you so much for a wonderful conversation today.
Thank you, David.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.